Please mind the gap between the train and the platform.
This is Barbican Station.
Hello and welcome to Barbican Station, a podcast looking at the works of Mick Herron from the website Spyride. My name is Jeff Quest, and I love reading and writing about espionage fiction, and I'm excited to talk to you about the Slough House series today. Before we get started, I have a favor to ask. Would you mind telling one other person about the podcast? If you know a Herron fan or someone you've pushed the books on to read, tell them to listen in as we dig into the books a little further. Thanks. Okay, so today I'm very pleased to have Grierson Professor of English Literature at the University of Edinburgh and spy fiction course leader and fan, Professor Penny Fielding, joining me today. Professor Fielding is one of the directors of the wonderful Edinburgh Spy Week program, which has had appearances in the past by spy authors such as Dame Stella Remington, Charles Cumming, Anthony Horowitz, Jeremy Duns, Adam Brooks, and, of course, Mick Herron. I've always been jealous looking at the programming of Spy Week, and it's on my bucket list. If, you know, we get back to some sort of normalcy and see events there return after all of this COVID craziness. Penny, thank you so much for joining me and talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
This episode, we're going to be talking about the seventh book in the series, Slough House. So before we get too far, though, I was wondering, Penny, how did you find this series initially?
Well, by accident. And actually, my reading of it was a bit of a chapter of accidents. I was flying to Dublin for work, and I realized I didn't have anything to read on the plane. So I went into the little bookshop in Edinburgh Airport. And there was a display of a very striking-looking book, which turned out to be Spook Street. So I bought it, and it's just a very short hop over to Dublin. And I was working, so I only read a little bit of it. And then I left it in the hotel by accident. Some lucky guest or hotel worker got that copy. But I'd been hooked by it, so I thought, well, perhaps I'd better go back to the beginning. So I read Slow Horses and Dead Lions. And then I thought, well, we better have Mick Herron to Spy Week because he is such a unique talent and such a, you know, a real breakthrough in spy writing. So at that point, he had written London Rules. So I read that and we had a wonderful event. That was a slot in Spy Week that we did for a couple of years where we interviewed a spy author and a detective author to see what the difference was. Of course, Mick is both. So we interviewed him with Denise Minor, who was an absolutely terrific Scottish detective writer, and got to know Mick a bit. He was a wonderful, wonderful interviewee. Yeah, has a very dry humour. So I've read them all in the wrong order. I did read Spook Street eventually. I haven't read Joe Country because I had both Joe Country and Slough House on my tottering pile of books to read when you were kind enough to ask me to do this. So I've just read Slough House. But, you know, I think it doesn't really matter so much with these books, partly because there are all those kind of infill novellas and additional books, none of which I've read, but also because they're so skillfully written that even though there are very long-running strands through the books with the same characters, they're very well crafted, so they are self-contained. You can read them. And there's also a certain pleasure, I think, about finding out about the prehistory of the characters that you like. I really want to find out the kind of horrible back history of Lech Wachinski, do you pronounce it?
Yeah.
Who appears kind of fully formed in Slough House, but I know kind of what happened a little bit before that. And also you get to really admire Mick Herron's prescience, you know, the way he seems mysteriously to know what's going to happen in world politics.
Yeah.
Which you get by either by rereading or by reading in the wrong order.
Yeah, well, I would recommend folks read them in order. I do think they are very much their own. He takes pains to make sure they're their own thing. And while he does like to pick up on threads that he drops in other books, it's never necessarily that if you haven't read one of the others, you couldn't read it and figure out what's going on. The interesting thing, like, you know, there's certain characters that, you know, appeared in books that aren't even official Slough House books. You know, I mean, you have like Nobody Walks. He introduces is one of the future slow horses there, and you get all of his backstory there, but you don't really, if you hadn't read that book, you wouldn't have known, but it's still, it doesn't affect that. It's just, it's interesting how he kind of likes to play with that a little bit. Obviously, as you were reading these books, there was something in there that made you think, hey, this is a writer that we need to try and pull in. So what is it about the writing that you think is so different?
Well, it's quite an achievement if you're writing within a genre, although genre writers don't like you to call them genre writers. if you're writing in a way that publishers recognize and sell books as a genre, then it's really quite difficult, I think, to change things too much or to be too idiosyncratic. Mm-hmm. And it can be quite a dangerous thing to do. And I think that in sort of the middle period, Le Carré, the writing gets quite difficult to read. It gets a little bit overwritten, a bit kind of baroque or precious. And McCarran, I think, pushes it almost to that edge occasionally, but totally gets away with it. So it's a mixture of that. Well, so much to say, you know, about his technique, the way he uses what's technically called free indirect discourse, where he goes into somebody else's speech patterns, mm-hmm. but it's still the third person narrator speaking. He uses that a lot. So you get this kind of shifting point of view between the characters. Sometimes we know what one character is thinking and the character that they're with doesn't. And this is all done through his really brilliant command of that free and direct speech. And then there's all the metaphors and similes. It's, you know, really quite kind of poetic and elaborate. Mm-hmm. Some of which you think there's a lot of this going on, but he does get away with it. And now, sometimes he'll introduce, you know, quite a literary device into a very, very taut passage where he might be describing someone's state of mind in a state of extremity or duress. And he'll throw in one of these metaphors. And I think they're really helpful. You know, they do help you understand what the experience of the characters is. So there's that. And I think we'll, you know, find plenty of other examples of his technique as we talk more. There's also, of course, you know, famously the way he manages to kind of marshal groups of characters and move them through the novel. I mean, that's only Dickens really can do that. And I know you've thought about Heron as quite a Dickensian character before, author before. You know, I think that's right. It's difficult to have that control when you're moving between groups. And I don't want to give away too many spoilers right at the very beginning, but there's a brilliant chapter, which we might come back to, where, you know, River and Sid are tackling the assassins. And it's so compelling. And at the same time, he's switching to conversation between Diana Taverner and Lamb, where a lot of the underlying plot is being revealed to you. And, you know, that's a real challenge for an author. So on the one hand, you've got this intense micro-focus, and he keeps pulling out and saying, yeah, forget about that, because now I'm going to tell you the stuff about the international intrigue. it's a fantastic chapter, and I was absolutely gripped.
Yeah, no, that was really good, and we definitely will dive in there. So let's start at the beginning, because I think what we really see at the very start is something that we've come to expect from the novels, where he gives us this almost cold open, feels almost unrelated to some of the later stuff a little bit. It's its own little vignette. And this one is where we have what appears to be an MI5 spy being hunted through London and killed, only to reveal the opposite, right? It's actually a Russian spy that MI5 has killed. That's just such a Heron, I don't know if I should call it an affectation at this point for those kind of rug pulling opening sequences. And I was curious what your thoughts about that were.
It's definitely a teaser. I mean, it really pulls you in because he can write those scenes so well where he's describing an action sequence, but he's also telling you what's going through the mind of the characters. And of course, people are not always what they appear to be. I mean, it's what any spy writer needs to be able to do. So the kind lady who invites the young woman into the shop, oh, turns out to be the assassin. So it's very, very skillful. But it's also it's a teaser in more ways than one, not only because we only at the very end realize that we're looking at a mirror image of what we thought, but also the assassin, then the MI5 operative, then sends a message to Diana Taverner with that Bond phrase, death to spies.
Oh, yes, right.
Smash Bjornen. and there's all, I mean, this could be quite heavy-handed in a book, in a series like this, but he does it with great lightness, that just reminder that this is not a Bond novel. it could be if he wanted, but there were just a few little references to that.
Yeah, well, when that phrase comes in, one of the underlings to Diana Taverner is like, what does that mean? And she's like, Google it, right? That's like kind of the little stinger on there. That's great.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Google it, yeah. There's quite a lot about Googling in the modern world of social media.
So now I'm curious what your thoughts are, because I, on a reread, knowing what's coming, a certain line stuck out to me, and it's this line where it says the agent who's on the run, right, kind of trying to lose this tale, says that they're thinking about a department made up of failures, losers assigned a dead-end desk, spending the rest of forever in the midst of thwarted ambition. And you could sum up the slow horses that way, but we now know that this was actually a Russian spy. So does that mean there is a Russian Slough House out there somewhere?
Well, it could be. I didn't notice that. And now I'm intrigued. I'm going to have to look that up. One of the things I like about this novel, we might talk about this a bit more, is the way it seems both completely beyond the Cold War and all those things are over now, but it's not. And there's that scene at the end of, towards the end of the novel, where Taverner is talking to her GRU counterpart. Mm. And that could be out of a Len Deighton novel, you know. They're just like, well, you know, we'll just smooth things over a little bit and everything will kind of go on forever as it normally does. So that kind of mirroring between the West and the East might suggest that there is indeed a Russian Slough House.
Well, I don't know. My guess is that was purely a misdirection that Heron threw in there for us to try, and because he likes to do those types of things to where it's get the reader thinking one thing when something else is going on. But I do hope that's maybe a thread that he comes back to at some point.
There's quite a lot in this novel which is clearly, well, not clearly, but which I think is being just left in place for future novels. I think there's quite a lot of setting up going on.
I agree with that, because, you know, I think one of the things that's interesting about this novel is when you boil it down to the plot, there actually isn't a whole lot going on. It's pretty simple. There's kind of like two threads. There's this thread of Sid and River kind of reconnecting and Slough House under fire. And then there's this thread with Diana and Peter Judd and that aspect. And they intermingle at various points, but that's kind of it as far as what we see in this novel, right?
Yeah, I kind of like that. I mean, all the Heron novels that I've read have been quite different from each other in that way, even though they have the same characters and the same style. Now, some of them take place over a short period of time, some a long period of time. I think one of them is Deadlines only has two sections. It doesn't have proper chapters. Yeah. But I can never remember plots or understand them anyway. I rather like this. I think it's quite a political novel, this one. I think they all are, but I think this one is very attentive to certain things that are going on in the world at the moment about democracy and international finance and the loss of power of individual nation states and so on. And that takes a bit of explanation. And he takes quite a while to set out this complicated deal that's been done between between Diana Taverner and partly Peter Judd, although he doesn't know anything that's going on, and this new character, Damien Cantle, who's new to me, mm-hmm. who is, he runs an internet TV station.
Right, Channel Go, it's called.
Channel Go. And he is completely without any ideology. This is what I found interesting in this novel. I know we're told that he's kind of beyond any specific political ideology, but the novel says he wants to be a player. And he kind of enters into the espionage world by having one of his former employees, who's now working as one of the dogs, steal some files. And I might come back to that central spy motif of stealing files. It's It's great. Not for any particular reason. The files turn out to have rather disastrous consequences for Slough House, particularly its former members. But he just does it. So there's this idea that we're not interested in politics, only entertainment. Cantor is able to make the most of that. And Peter Judd, has now temporarily left politics. This may have happened in Joe Country, but he's been peeled away from Boris yes. Johnson. Which I think is a good idea, because Boris Johnson would never be capable of that kind of long-term planning that we see in Peter Judd. And, you know, he says to Taverner, you've been bureaucratized too long. And so many spy novels are about bureaucracy.
Yeah.
A lot of the Carré novels are about it. I mean, even some of the very early novels like... The Secret Agent, Conrad's The Secret Agent, about bureaucracies. But that's a kind of rather chilling statement, I think. And the novel goes kind of beyond or looks beyond a world where individual nation states have secret services that are bureaucracies or civil services, even that are also bureaucracies. And it looks at, you know, what some people think is going on in the world now, that we all live in a kind of transnational, apolitical kleptocracy. And I think the novel does capture that very well. It's kind of transnational crime syndicate.
And it also touches on just the, not to get too conspiracy minded, but just the fear, right, that all of these forces out there are being manipulated, right? Yeah. I mean, the yellow vests, we have Judd kind of puppet mastering that for his own kind of purposes that are still a little, you're not quite sure where he's going, but it definitely, he's trying to mastermind things in a way that, you know, I mean, that especially, you know, I read this book right after January 6th here in the U.S., and that was, you know, it's a little chilling to read that right after that. So, you know, I do think, you know, similarly to some of his other books, when he does decide to make kind of political forecasts, he does have a good sense of this is what we might be looking at down the line.
And Brexit is kind of hovering in the background, although it's never mentioned. In fact, it's mentioned as they have some phrase about, you know what.
Yes.
Yeah. I think it is clear that Peter Judd has a long-term plan for, what's his name, Flinty. Flinty, one of the yellow vests who Judd has now kind of made. He's a creature. And I think it's an important part of that the novel's thinking through our current political situation. The yellow vests are, you know, it's a political protest with no actual politics. They don't particularly believe in anything. They're sort of against it all. They could be against anything that you throw in their path and tell them to be against. That's the one bit of the novel I felt a little bit less compelling. There's quite a lot of interaction between Flint and Judd. Yeah. It's, some of it's very funny because Judd is so outrageously snobbish and is always pointing out... you know, the differences between him and Flint, and Flint's lack of taste and lack of education. So Peter Judd has left politics, at least he's left official politics. He's now working behind the scenes, and he has this PR firm which only has very select clients, and it's called Bullingdon Fop. So it's called after this dining club at the University of Oxford for very rich and idiotic people. There's a famous they're very rich, and they go around smashing up restaurants and then sort of throwing £50 notes at the restaurateur, you know, because that's what they're like. But there was a famous photograph that circulates on the internet, and you can actually find it, of these ridiculous characters, students standing on the steps of an Oxford College in their Bullingdon dining uniform.
Oh.
Two of those are Boris Johnson and David Cameron. So I think that's a little nod to Mick Herron's alma mater. He got a Mick's degree from Oxford. So
sounds very Woodhouse-y in there.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I thought was interesting, there's this quote, and I think it plays very well into this whole concept of the yellow vests that he's talking about, is that old saw about learning from the past didn't always mean studying monstrous historical movements to ensure they never happened again. It could indicate an intention to perfect their trajectories in the hope that they'd triumph the next time. And I think that encapsulates Peter Judd to a T there.
He's such an opportunist. I'm sure he's going to play a big part in the next novel. Although who knows? Who knows? Who can say with McCann?
You know, we talked about how the plot tends to be kind of simple in this one, I think. For me, it was for two reasons. One, because it really gave him an opportunity to just focus on the characters and have some really great interactions between everybody, all the different folks. And then the other aspect was to normally, I think, in a lot of his previous books, he's been more interested in the switching of points of views or surprising you in ways you're thinking one thing and you find out something else is going on. And I think other than that one at the very beginning, he really saves it, keeps his powder dry for the end.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that was what he was really shooting for in this whole novel. That was kind of where he was going. And yeah. So everything was kind of like down to really make that have the greatest impact, which I appreciated in this one.
Yes, I agree. And that end is such a virtuoso piece of writing. You can totally see he wants to get to it without too many twists and turns. But yes, that's right. I mean, that does involve a very shocking and unexpected event.
Yeah.
Perhaps we should keep that one secret.
We'll get there. I'm not trying to get ahead of myself here. So the book starts out, we see kind of what we're used to, although it felt a little shorter this time than maybe we've seen in the past, where we're introduced to Slough House. And this one I really enjoyed because it's as an estate agent, which was very fun as we're looking through Slough House and getting our introduction to that space.
Yes, that's great. It's a great parody of an estate agent trying to sell a really awful property. And I think that it works so well. And it's also quite helpful because you do get a bit of a sense of the layout of Slough House and what it looks like. Although, of course, Jeff, you have seen Slough House, unlike me. Although next time I go to London, I will. And I think also that kind of feeds into the way the book is. It's kind of about property. So it's about bricks and mortar property. So there's another scene in what they call it, the Needle, you know, so
yes,
which is a fictional version of the Shard in London. And Taverner Diana has a kind of secret little safe house hidden away in London.
Yes.
And the first thing they do, and she lets the slow horses use it and momentarily. And the first thing they do when they go through is kind of work out how much it must have cost because it's in a lot better shape than the Slough House. And then, of course, it's also about property, as in who owns whom. It's about people owning each other. Somebody warns somebody else about Judd. I think that he'll steal anything that isn't nailed down. So I think it's just a nice little nod at that thematic strand as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, and for the first time, we see Diana Taverner's home. That makes an appearance where Jackson kind of confronts her there as well. So we do get a lot of nods to that whole aspect of London now, because it is crazy. I think we've talked about that in the show before, but being able to purchase any sort of property in London has become you need to have a small fortune or a hidden diamond to be able to do that.
Yes.
The other part that we see at the beginning is the Slough House folks are wondering why they've been wiped from the books in Regent's Park. And that it's interesting how he manages to play that into his further issues with the slow horses being hunted down, because it does kind of confuse it muddy the waters a little bit there for a while. And it's fun to watch the slow horses have to do some spycraft, because normally, you know, they're just thrown in the thick of it. And this time we get to see them kind of doing some of that tradecraft stuff that maybe we don't see as much from all of them.
Yes, that's a wonderful, wonderful thing about this book, because I think all of us who read spy novels love a bit of tradecraft. They do. I mean, they also make mistakes, as they always will do in a Slough House novel. There's a kind of really awful and embarrassing and funny scene where Shirley and Lech think they're being followed and they're accost this guy in a public lavatory, but oh, he's not actually, it turns out, a trainee from the park, which is it's one of the uses that the slow horses are being put to. So Taverner's using them as targets for, and that's what they originally think that is going on. And then it turns out they're being killed. And it's indifferent. So there are two explanations for that. But there are some great scenes. There's a I like that one in really early in the novel, where Louisa, who doesn't really feature all that much in this novel, but she has had other novels kind of more to herself, is buying some new trainers, and she knows someone's following her. And this is where we realise that it's Park, because they both get the same signal text on their phones at the same time. So there are lots of really nice little details that use modern technology, you know, as part of the plot like that, while at the same time having that fantastic old school, you know, use of paper files, because Molly Doran makes an appearance with her files. Yeah, she's a bit like, what's her name in Tinker Tailor, Connie Sachs.
Yes.
This older woman who knows everything and has everything written down. And so she's kind of guarding the past. And, well, that's how these slow horses start to be bumped off. That's how they work out what's going on, because it's only those who have paper files that are being killed, because the files have been stolen physically. And so newer recruits like Lech are not immediately in the firing line.
Right, yeah. And there's a nice little bit of foreshadowing that Heron does in this, because we have Catherine kind of doorsteps Molly on her way home and starts asking, you know, why are the slow horses not on the digital files at the park anymore? Do you still have our paper files there? And she says yes. And so it's a nice little planting that seed that there's this paper files but and digital, and that paper is why all the old slow horses are getting hunted down. Which I liked that was smart on a reread, something that you kind of pick up.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of those kind of seeds dropped very early that he pays off towards the end.
Yes. I mean, I did have to look back over the novel just to work out exactly what that plot is, although it actually is very well plotted. There are certain scenes in which it is explained to you, where the slow horses work it out among themselves, or Jackson gets it out of Taverner. They're quite nicely spaced, you know, throughout the novel. But I did miss a number of details the first time.
We get another great spy location in this this novel, where we have Old Miles, is like this kind of run-down convenience store for spies, basically, where they have all of the odd kind of Eastern European cigarettes and booze that spies might have gotten used to in their time overseas. And they go there and hang out and trade war stories, right?
I love that scene. And you can really imagine that in the TV series just being a brilliant scene if they get as far as Slough House. So Owen Miles is this relic of the Cold War. He sells Russian cigarettes and vodka, I think. And above his shop, which is about to close down, so that's another example of this idea of property. He has a kind of meeting room where everyone, you know, hangs out, and all the old spooks and ex-spooks hang out. To swap stories, and Jackson is there, and that starts off one of the plot strands. But it's also a way in which the novel, I really like this, it is about how this ultra-modern present is haunted by the Cold War, these ghosts of the Cold War, you know, like Old Miles and Molly Doran's files, and then that kind of old-style spy swap thing that's going on, and this the scene with on the phone between Diana and the GRU man, whose name I've forgotten, Rosnikov or something like that.
Yeah, something. Yeah, he's the Vasily or something like that, I think. Yes. Yeah, I there is a sense that, you know, at least in Heron's world, his alternate reality, that the Cold War is heating up, and that there is this kind of acceleration. And I think, you know, for folks in the UK, that's got to feel very real because of some of these things that have been going on, you know, the poisonings and all of that. I mean, it doesn't seem like it has ended, and it seems to be accelerating a little bit.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the novel takes its cue from the Skripal poisonings in Salisbury a few years ago, where the two poisoners had themselves caught on camera, whether because they weren't very good or because they just didn't care, probably the latter.
Yeah.
And some members of the public were caught up in that, and one of them died. So that's played through the novel in a slightly different way. But yes, it is very close to living memory. And there are just a couple of little tiny references also to Russian interference in the American election. A lot of people here also think that that was true with Brexit. So it's certainly that's done with a very light touch and just a few tiny little references. Yes, the main allusion is to the Skripal poisonings, which has a horrible repetition at the end of the novel.
Yes. Well, you know, anything to get more tourists visiting the cathedrals, I think, is important, right?
Yeah, they did go to visit the cathedral, and that was part of Putin's defense, but they were tourists, and Salisbury is a very famous old cathedral.
One of the other parts that happens after this visit to Old Miles, which is a great location, I'm almost like it was sad to see it like that it's closing. Like I wanted to see that reoccur in another novel because it was so distinctive. But after that, Jackson is followed by somebody named Reese Nesmith III. And this is a person with dwarfism, which leads to all sorts of offensive remarks by Lamb. And so this is where I've got an English professor on the show, so I've got to ask your kind of professional opinion on something. I'm curious about where you fall on the idea of kind of separating the author from their work, and specifically offensive things or bad things that a character does, separated from the author's intent. Because I think you see that a lot where it's hard for folks to do that, right? If there's a bad character in a book, then obviously it's the point of view of the author. And how does that work? How do you parse that out?
Well, I think it's clear in these novels that that is not the view of Mick Herron, who's, as far as we know, his politics are reasonably left of center. I mean, the debate that's going on about this in universities at the moment is less perhaps about what the author intends, but what is the effect of people reading it? So that if you were someone who was affected by dwarfism, and you know, would you necessarily want to sit through a whole lot of jokes from Jackson Lamb? And I think Herron does take this pretty to the limits of what is now in the current climate acceptable. But you know, Nesmith has quite a good trajectory in the novel. They kind of adopt him as a kind of civilian slow horse at the end.
Yeah.
He has an important mission of his own, which he uses, and he feels he's getting revenge for the murder of his boyfriend, who was a Russian journalist knocked off, as he says, by Putin. And that's actually how Lamb starts to realize what's going on. So Nesmith is extremely important in that kind of gradual revealing of knowledge, not only to us, but also to Lamb. And I like to think, although I don't know whether this is true, that at the end of the novel, Lamb beats up Tom O'Doyle, who is the dog, who used to work for Cantor. And that apparently is because Tom O'Doyle called Molly Doran a crip, because Molly is in a wheelchair. So for the first time ever in Slough House, Jackson Lamb stands up for political correctness.
I mean, I think it's interesting. I mean, you see this also, you know, like with Ian Fleming and Bond, you know, how do you separate those two and their views? And it makes me wonder, do you think in 20 years time that we'll be looking back on Slow Horses and the way that we see Jackson Lamb talking about, say, Roddy Ho, or joking about Shirley Dander and her cocaine habits? I mean, do you think that will still hold up then, and we'll be able to look at it through that lens of understanding there or not? I'm just curious.
I hope so. I mean, I don't know. I think that the way in which these are clearly points of view mediates our reading of the novel. I mean, we don't actually think that we're being asked to read this novel to, you know, laugh at dwarves or, you know, think that it's a good idea to offer alcoholics a drink, which is what Lamb does with Standish. No, I don't think so. I think that we will continue to be able to read these novels as novels about people who don't know how to address other people properly. I mean, the thing is, if you laugh at the jokes, then are you complicit? Some of those jokes about Nesmith are quite funny. So that's just a question I think that readers will need to decide.
And I do think, you know, one of the, I don't know if it's a mitigating factor, but I mean, it's obvious that all of the things that Lamb is doing come from like a deep self-loathing, right? Yeah. I mean, that's where he's, you know, he hates himself, and so he's taking it out on the world, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And also perhaps the disguise, he needs to disguise the fact he does care about his team. And he's outraged that both Taverner and the GRU are coming for them. You know, he acts for them even when they don't necessarily know that. He is a little bit soft about this in this novel, I don't know. towards the slow horses.
He does seem to have a little bit of a thawing, maybe, perhaps, mm-hmm. over the course of the novels. I think he was a more of a harder edge. More of that was, those comments were perhaps a little sharper, I think, mm-hmm. than in this one.
He's actually not in this one quite as much, I think, as some of the others. I mean, for me, the main focus was on Sid Baker mm-hmm. and River, those scenes. I thought the depiction of Sid was absolutely fantastic. And Lam did seem to be slightly taking a back seat. He's so dominant that he does take up space in any scene that he's in. But I don't know, I kind of felt that he was a little bit less to the front of this novel.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think his action really comes in at the end when we see him taking on Cantor and the team kind of taking him on and him yeah. setting that up, yeah. I think.
And that's so well worked out. And they work it out. And even Roddy Ho manages to do a bit of tradecraft right. He gets exactly what he's been told to do. And all he has to do is keep a parking space available. But he does it. You know, and they... And it's funny as well as impressive. With all the, they're kind of acting as spies as well as being spies.
Yes, well, it felt like they'd all watched some of the old Mission Impossible shows, and that was kind of where they came up with their plan.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is funny in and of itself, yeah. I think.
So. But it works.
So. Yeah. Well, let's jump into that River and Sid relationship, because I do think that is crucial to this novel and giving it its heft. Sid, who we only saw in Slow Horses, the very first yeah. book, you know, during that novel, we see River and Sid kind of starting to get to know each other. There's a crucial scene where they finally kind of come to some sort of understanding while on surveillance. But then immediately after that, Sid is shot and we all assume killed until she reappears here. And I was wondering how you felt about their relationship, because given the fact that they didn't have that deep of a relationship in the first book, it does seem like a little bit of a leap to where we end up in this book. I was curious what you thought about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to take it on trust because it's Slow Horses was quite a long time ago and might have forgotten that. It is the case that we realize that he is in love with her, and that whole strand is a bit different from the other strands in the novel. You know, it's very poetically written, and River keeps buying her cheese for some reason. She's going out to the shop to get cheese. But the thing that I really liked about that aspect of the novel was the way Heron portrays that idea of someone coming back to life. So both in her own head and in River's head.
Yeah.
And in a way, I think this might compensate for that genuine problem which you articulate. Sid is kind of working, trying to regain her personality. She's physically damaged because she had a bullet in her head, but also she's kind of putting herself back together. She exists in this really strange world where things are quite imprecise and she has to remember things. And we find out at the end that she has remembered something, an aspect of tradecraft that saves her life in one of those fantastic moments. But it's all quite dreamlike. She lives in this dreamlike world where it's as if the things that she is experiencing herself are happening outside her. It's almost as if she's looking at them in a film. And the world outside is quite, for her, it's quite dreamlike as she is kind of remembering who she is, because she's been in a farmhouse in Cumbria for two years.
And she's kind of nestled in this library that's the only spot that is filled in this house. It does have this kind of, as you say, dreamlike kind of attitude, right? This is the only solid thing in there. And, you know, picking up a little bit on what you're saying there, I think also we have the case where River, even though Sid has been dead for a while to him, she hasn't been dead in his mind. You get the sense that he's been thinking about her for the years in between, and she's still a living presence. And I think the fact that Sid is so damaged right now makes it easier for him to make that connection. If she were fully whole and reappearing, I think that relationship couldn't work as well as it does in this novel.
I think that's a really good point. Yeah, that's right. And so they're both kind of piecing things together. Again, everyone is sort of haunted in the novel. And I think it's right that coming together again of Sid and River takes place in the OB's house. Mm. nearly entirely, as you say, stripped of furniture, apart from books and a letter opener. And there's quite a lot of things, this idea of being, so the house is haunted by the OB. I noticed quite a lot of references to haunting, to ghosts. Molly Doran's actually called a ghost on wheels, which I quite like. And it's as if Sid is kind of being haunted by herself, you know, by her old life. It's gradually becoming more and more apparent to her.
Well, she's got this kind of gray, like silver streak in her hair now, as well as the scar from the bullet that grazed her head.
And she has, the bullet talks to her.
Yeah.
I mean, that could have been a really bad bit of writing, but I think it's brilliant. She's imagining her own life outside herself. The bullet speaks with the voice of Hercule Poirot, which is a kind of joke about, you know, his catchphrase about little grey cells and the fact she's had the bullet in the brain. But, you know, I think also it's if this were an Agatha Christie novel with Poirot in it, everything would just be so much simpler. You know, murder would have taken place. And then there's a joke here, I think, about the fact that she's in a kind of library, you know, because Poirot is always assembling everyone in the library and then, you know, tells the story. We know who's done it. Everyone goes home apart from the guilty party. But that kind of narrative security, I guess you'd say, isn't available to Sid. And, you know, the bullet, she also hears, it's really creepy, she hears the noise of the bullet. So the bullet speaks partly with the voice of Poirot, but also this sort of sound that so she's reliving this moment where she was killed the first time. And then, you know, her life is certainly not safe in this novel either.
Yeah. I found it very haunting, this idea, too, of the people that are coming to kill her.
Yeah, so
these
creepy.
Missionaries, and the two characters are, he does a great job of setting them up. And at first, you're not sure. Like, he does a credible job of making you wonder whether Sid really is just kind of out of it. I mean, she reappears. She's got this story that's just kind of bonkers on the face of it. But as you peel it back and you see more about this assassination team, there is Jim and Jane, yes. And they're just utterly scary characters. Like when we see them, when they encounter Struan Loy, who is one of the earliest slow horses there from the first book. And I love that in just a few pages, Heron manages to recreate this character that we only saw very briefly in the first book and give him this just utterly real personality and just terrible backstory of what's happened to his life. I really loved that bit.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, it's horrible because we're sort of with him when he dies in this horrible way. But yes, that's another property thing, because he's set up his company to sell, you know, shipping containers as homes to people, but it's failed and he's living in one.
Well, and this is very much, you know, I think it's, I kind of mentioned it before, but very much a Slow Horses sequel where, you know, you almost could have read Slow Horses and Slough House and not anything in between, because I feel like there's so many little things that Heron picks up on from that first book. I don't know if it's because of the TV show coming out and that was part of it, or whether he had, because of the show, he's reread the first book and thought it would be fun to drop some of that stuff in here. But I mean, we have Judd cozying up with, you know, right-wing elements again, just like in the first book.
Yeah.
Sid returns from the first book. We also get those two slow horses that were kicked to the curb in that book come back. You know, we see Taverner back at the Globe, the bench along the river there. We have another Lamb and Taverner interaction on the towpath. You know, they're back to Blake's grave. You know, there's another call back there. Yeah. So I really loved all that stuff. For a long time reader, I think it was just a little bit of catnip there.
Yes, and of course the titles are quite similar. So
yes. One of the other things, you know, we're kind of jumping around and I'm enjoying that. So I'm going to go to another character that I feel is fast becoming one of my favorite characters of the books. And that's Shirley Dander, because I think we get some real character momentum from her in this book, because, you know, she had this very strong relationship with her past partner, Marcus, right?
Yeah.
Who was the first person that she actually seemed to have some sort of connection with outside of everything else in her life. And she also kind of had that a little bit with her last partner, but both of them have had bad ends. And so she connects up with Lek. in this one. And I really liked that dynamic between the two of them. I think that was a lot of fun. And Leck really kind of grows from his previous appearances. I think that was really great. And I hope we continue to see her take a stronger role in the books, because she's really an interesting character.
I like her. I like her. She's a bit different from some of the other slow horses because she's not quite as vulnerable as some of them are. And she's the only one who seems to be really happy in her own body. She has this rather strange shape, but she likes dancing, you know, and she likes to enjoy herself just in a pure bodily way, you know, whether that's drugs or dancing. And she just does it. She doesn't seem to have this kind of endless self-questioning that some of the other slow horses have. And she's really, really rude, but not in that ironic way that Lam is. So Lam knows he's being offensive, but she just kind of says things, you know, because they come into her head. I really like her. I'm looking forward to seeing her in the TV series.
Yeah, I think she's a lot of fun. And I think she's also one of the characters that almost is at peace with where she's at in Slough House. You know, she's not. Would she love to get back to where she was? Yes, but I think she's also found some equilibrium there, whether she'd maybe admit it to herself or not.
Yeah, I think so. And she just seems able to deal with every situation. She's part of this accidentally. In fact, she coshes the guy who they think is a, and then she's who they think is following Lech. Then they go to a pub, and she pulls out the kosh and puts it on the table, and he says, don't put it away. And she says, if anybody asks, I'll say it's a sex toy. She just doesn't care. And so she has, I mean, I think, you know, if you compare her with Sid, both of whom are extremely capable women and, you know, who are very, very good at being spies and good at tradecraft, although Shirley does kosh the wrong person and Sid koshes the right person or kills him in another way. You know, it's a relief, I think, to have that female character who isn't vulnerable, you know, who isn't an ex-alcoholic or who hasn't, I mean, her partners have been killed, but she just hasn't had that long-term relationship that Louisa, a longer relationship, I should say, that Louisa has with Min Harper in one of the earlier books. I really like her and I hope nothing happens to her.
Yes, I know. Well, that's always the worry. As soon as you really start to like a character, you got to be on the watch and worried. We kind of jumped away from River and Sid, so I'm going to loop back there again, because in spite of being young in terms of the books, he's really been through the ringer. And you know, and there's a talk about him hanging it up and trying to settle down with Sid. You get that sense in this book. But there's also been this kind of slow burn relationship between him and Louisa.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, what are your thoughts on that? Where is River's head, I think, at this point?
I don't know. I mean, River is, if there were to be a central character other than Jackson, it would be River. I mean, River is the closest person to a kind of traditional protagonist. But I think you put it really well. Where is his head? He's a bit vague. It's a bit difficult to know what he wants. You know, there was that, I may have got this wrong. Is it in Spook Street where he goes to France and he's having that relationship? That's a different kind of novel, I think, to this one. You certainly can't imagine him and Sid kind of settling down and, you know, sort of doing up the obese house at all. There's something unfixed, I think, about River. Maybe that's why he's called River. No, he just kind of never seems to quite know what he wants or where he's going. I mean, he certainly wants to save Sid, but there's something a little bit unformed about River, which I think is interesting because that sets him apart. Because the other slow horses they're not caricatures at all, but they, you know, there are specific aspects of them by which you recognise them. Maybe that their physical attributes. Although, just rereading this novel, you don't get many actual descriptions of characters. You get certain aspects of them, which are very striking. Like Shirley has this funny shape, and obviously Lam is fat, and Standish wears this sort of very old-fashioned dress, and you get it through metaphor. There's a bit, sorry, I'm digressing again, but there's a maybe that where Lam is described as if someone had set fire to a rubbish bin. But River, I don't know what River looks like. I don't really know how old he is. I'm thinking sort of 30s, but there is something a little bit unformed about him, which I think is good. I like that. And that will sort of carry him through all the novels.
Well, you get in the first like the first novel or two, he's much more specific about kind of giving some descriptions for River.
Uh-huh.
And in Spook Street, you get a little bit of that as well, just because of this twin kind of other character, right?
That's the one because they think he's dead.
It's him. Yeah. But he does have that sense of not having something to grasp onto as far as what is driving him, other than that he's always wanted to be a spy. And you get, I think I had to pick one characteristic for him, is he is a kind of an adrenaline junkie, right? I mean, he wants to be in the action. He wants to be doing something. That it's even mentioned there that he got kind of a thrill from that whole insane sequence that they have with these Russian assassins in there, right?
Yeah, and that's made specific. I can't find the page number now, but there's something about, oh, he was on a mission again. And
yes,
he's adrenaline.
There's also a good line about in there. It's when it's talking about River and Sid. Heron says they'd fought through most of their short relationship, which was a familiar story when it came to River and women. Though in his defense, by no means all of them ended up shot in the head.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's been other references where River does not have friends. He doesn't have any friends. You know, he's like, he's trying to think of who he'd call if he needed to. Yeah. And the list is Louisa and then like a big question mark.
Yeah. But none of them seems to have any friends. You don't find out much. I mean, interestingly, River is the only one who we really see in his home life. I mean, we know that other of them have property and live in places. But the OB's house seems to be a real character in the novels.
Yes.
Itself.
Which makes the ending even more tragic when you read that.
I know. He's killed by... Well, is he? No, we don't know. Edit that out. The house itself.
Yeah, there's also another funny line in there where Heron says, River's brief tenure at the park seemed a decade ago, because obviously he's compressed, you know, between the books, the time is compressed. But actually, the original book did come out 10 years ago. So that's a nice little nod to that whole thing.
One of the things I liked, this is always the case, but I particularly noticed it in this novel, is the way he can move between, you know, that very ironically distanced, detached, wry, black humour that, you know, everyone loves in the novel. But here, and particularly with Sid, there's this kind of pathos. There's one line which, there's a kind of fairy tale quality, I think, about Sid's trajectory. The assassins who start off looking like missionaries, I think are described as kind of fairy tale villains.
Yes, there is.
Later on. And then there's this slide, which actually comes up twice. It's when this very extended scene where the assassins are coming for her.
Yeah.
And even before they come, she's in River's house or the OB's house, and she doesn't know whether she's safe or not. There's a line that says, she was like someone in a wood who lay down and covered themselves with leaves as if that would keep them safe. And I thought that was such an evocative line. I thought the babes in the wood or someone lost in the wood, and they cover themselves with leaves, this fragile cover. I loved that line. And it actually comes up a couple of times, neither of which I can find.
Well, and it plays to a little bit of both what we see happen and upending those expectations a little bit for that too, because, you know, she's the damsel in distress for River to chase after and try and rescue, right? And he does. But at the same time, she does take matters into her own hands, right? She's picked up from the Obi's house and they're driving her to the lake to try and kill her. And right before they're going to get her out of the car is when she pulls the Chekhov's letter opener out and kills the male assassin and makes a run for it, right?
She does. It's great. It's great. And I genuinely didn't know whether she was going to survive that or not. It's very tense. And then she says, well, you know, it's your own fault, to the assassin, because you allowed me to pick that up when you made me put my coat on. And this is when she takes the letter open. And she turns out to be this kind of avenging action hero. I love that whole scene, the build up to it, and then that kind of spooky drive through the countryside. You know, most of the novel is set in the city, but quite a lot of this set in this rather spooky countryside, with trees that seem to be waving at her, and this demonic way. And then the extended action scene where the assassins try to kill her, she kills one of them, the river turns up, and there's more trying to kill each other. Yeah. Eventually, you know, it's all resolved. And then, in typical Heron fashion, they have to go back and get the bodies.
Yeah.
And it's turned into a farce because there's dogging.
Yeah.
Going
well,
on.
it was quite a more of a violent scene than I think we've seen in some of his other novels. The fight sequence goes on for quite a while, and it's pretty brutal between River and the female assassin. Yeah. And River ends up drowning her the same way that she was going to try and drown Cid. So it was quite a surprise to see that, because so many times Heron. Well, there is violence in the books. It tends to happen off page. Yeah. You know, there's a cut to a different scene or something like this. And here we really get in the weeds of what's going on.
Yeah, I thought that. I suppose we're, in a way, a little bit prepared for it with the horrible death of Strew and Loy, who we don't care about.
Yeah.
And you know, the possibility that these two characters who do care about might not survive, I think, you know, makes that scene even more gripping.
Well, and the interesting thing with that scene as well is that it comes relatively early in the book. I mean, it's right around before, I think, even the two-thirds mark, if I'm remembering correctly. So we still have a significant portion of the book to go, and it did leave a little bit of, like, where are we going to go from here as far as that, because it was so distinctive. And so, like, this team is now kind of off the board, which also just plays into the final twist, right? I think, you know, taking them out of action lulls everybody into a false sense of security, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. I was really impressed by the structure of the novel. Some of the other novels I've read, there have been bits where you have to concentrate, you know, deliberately a bit harder. But this one I found just a real pleasure to read.
You know, we're going to jump to the spoilers because I feel like we're there.
Okay.
You know, one of the things that I thought was great, too, is that Heron, you know, like I said, he leaves his twists for the end, but he foreshadows that stuff so wonderfully. I mean, there's this talk of when the assassins are at the house, right? They're peering through the door, letter opener. They're jiggling the doorknob. That's at a page 149 of a 300-page book. And he just drops that there and then lets it sit for the next, you know, 140 pages until we get the moment where River is going in through the front door. Was that as shocking to you as it was to me? Because when you look back on it, you understand that they were actually there for River. They were putting that on the doorknob. They weren't trying to get Cid initially, and that came later. And so it totally makes sense when you look back on it. Yeah. And it was totally unexpected for me, even though it was completely plotted out perfectly.
Same for me. Absolutely. I think that handled brilliantly. And that sense of you were reading that and you didn't notice at the time, sort of feel, you know, that we're guilty of not protecting River. It's so well done. That all those chapters, that gradual build-up where these assassins who seem like Mormon missionaries are getting closer and closer. And then, you know, we discover that it wasn't, their target was not quite what we thought, or not only who we thought, that they're also coming from River.
Yeah, and I thought that it was really, at the end, we see Cid finds River in the kitchen on the floor, and it's just this, again, this twinning of slow horses where River was in that same situation with Cid in the end of, you know, in that book. And I think it might have even been in a kitchen where that happened, or maybe it was the doorway, but it's just, it's like she's holding on to River as he's, you know, potentially dying. I don't know. I guess that's what I want to get your read on. Where you're feeling there?
I just don't know. I don't know. But if I was putting money on it, I think he's probably going to be okay. But maybe, I mean, it would be just like Heron to keep us guessing over the course of a novel. I mean, maybe the next novel he won't appear and he'll be resurrected in the 10th novel or something. What do you think?
I think you're right. I don't. My feeling is it would have been even more definitive if he was going to do it, perhaps.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like he left it kind of a little vague. That I think he probably is going to come through it. However, I do think, will he survive? probably. Will he be okay? Maybe not, right?
Good
think,
point.
You know, he's already so damaged. It's hard to see how he isn't even more so after this, right?
Yeah. No, I think that's right. And I think that's perhaps one of the reasons that Herod will keep him on, you know, because having invested so much in this traumatic sequence of events in the end, we do want to find out what effect this will have had on River if he survives.
Yeah, I think that would be, I'd like to see that. I enjoy this series so much, but I also enjoy that Herod isn't afraid to upset the apple cart every once in a while,
yeah,
and shuffle things around and let us see new things or people interacting with each other in different ways. And I think because, as you said, River is, for lack of someone else, the protagonist, if you're going to pick one of the series, I think changing him in that way will be helpful for the series for its longevity.
That's a good point.
I also think, too, that River has been at such a low, like this is going to make him decide whether he wants to keep it up or not, right?
Yeah.
Keep going.
Yeah, I think that's right. We'll have to wait for quite a while to find out, I think.
Yes, well, the next one they just announced the title is going to be called Bad Actors.
Oh, okay.
And I think it's coming out in next February, from what I saw, okay, according to Amazon.
All right, good.
And Bad Actors actually gets a shout out in here where there's a reference to Bad Actors in this book. So Herod, again, kind of pulling those titles from previous novels. He likes to do that as well.
I think it's a real credit to John Murray, the publisher, that they've allowed the series to go where Mick wants it to go. And, you know, the first couple of novels were well received, but I think you would know more about this than I do, but they weren't bestsellers.
Yeah.
And suddenly they took off and he became the sensation he is now.
Yeah, no, it's definitely to John Murray's credit, at least in the UK, for really pushing those books and giving them the promotion that they obviously needed to really take off. And I think it's only going to grow with the TV series. I don't know if you've been following that at all, but
I haven't. I know they've cast Gary Oldman as Jackson Lamb. Of course, you first think, hang on, it didn't look at all like Jackson Lamb. But then Alec Guinness didn't look at all like George Smiley. So, and Oldman is a super actor. And, you know, it does sound like they're putting a fair amount of money into it. Oldman isn't going to come cheap.
Yes.
So, I'm looking forward. It's on Apple, isn't it? I don't have that. I'm definitely going to be watching it.
Yeah, more of the casting continues to kind of leak out, and it does seem like they're really assembling a really good group of actors for the different characters. You know, they got Kristen Scott Thomas as Diana Taverner.
Perfect.
And they're doing a really, what looks like a nice job. They actually went on location to the building that Herod picked as Slough House, and they set dress that entire street like the book. So it should be pretty fun to watch that, at the very least, for folks who've read the books and kind of have envisioned it in their minds. I think it's really going to be fun. So
yeah. I think they will adapt very well. I mean, it's obviously with any book that has such a distinctive narrative voice and narrative texture, some of that gets lost. But the characters and the plotting are just so wonderful, and just that atmosphere, just the creation of Slough House is so wonderful. I think it'll adapt well.
Yeah, well, and what's your opinion of adaptions from novels? Are you pro or against as a English professor?
I am pro. Completely. I mean, they're different things. Some are good, some are bad. There are films and TV series that are better than the novels. I think one of the finest bits of television ever is the adaptation of Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy with Alec Guinness. And I've seen that about three times. And we teach Tinker Tailor as a novel on my course at Edinburgh University, and show the students that first episode of the suspects coming in. Listeners probably won't remember this, but all the people who may be the mole come in, when we meet them all before anybody says a word, just by their kind of body language. It's just so good. And I think these kind of long, multi-character novels work quite well. There are some fantastic adaptations of Dickens. And I think the adaptation of Dickens' late novel, Our Mutual Friend, which is a bit kind of Heron-like, I think it's either BBC or Channel 4, I can't remember. I think it's better than the novel in some respects. There are too many characters in Our Mutual Friend, and they get rid of some of them. And it's just a fantastic bit of television. So I'm completely in favour of adaptations. Some are good, some are bad, but they're different texts, so it doesn't really matter.
Sure. Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to it. It seems like they've assembled a really good group of people, both behind the scenes and in front of the camera. So I'll be looking forward to that. And they're still filming now. Apparently, they've been filming for a long time, but they're doing both the first book and the second book right now. So that should be good.
It must have been delayed by the pandemic.
Yeah. So then I want to ask you, what's your opinion of the Slough House series within kind of the wider modern spy fiction world? Like, where do you see it sitting and fitting? Or does it fit? It seems like it is, for all of the spy tropes, Heron doesn't seem to be feeling necessarily beholden to that. I think he's kind of outside of where you think of normal spy fiction, if there is a normal spy fiction. And so I guess I just wanted your thoughts on that.
I think that's right. I think there are authors writing at the moment who write quite literary, in a good way, spy fiction, but it's not, they don't try and mess around with the tone. I mean, Charles Gummings, for example, I think is a fantastic writer. Adam Brooke, who we also have had at Spy Week, he did the Spies and Detectives thing with Val McDermott.
Oh, okay.
That was a lovely evening.
Yeah, his novels were great.
I mean, I think his three Chinese set novels are brilliant. I think they are some of the best of modern spy writing, but he's not trying to break the mold. They're just so brilliantly written and well-informed, and he was a foreign correspondent in China for the BBC. But Mick Heron is different from those because he is breaking the mold a bit. And when we think of books that we want to put on the course or get the students to read, they have to be books that you can talk about for 2 hours, because that's how long a seminar is. And some of the novels which I love most, I think, well, could we talk about those for 2 hours? And you could definitely, I mean, as your podcast shows, you can talk about these novels for a long time. So, I mean, obviously, with my profession, I don't think being literary is a problem. So it's a compliment to him from me to say that they are quite literary. There's a lot to say about them, though, about their technique and about the way they play with the genre. You know, as we talked about at the beginning, you know, it has to be a novel that you can talk about for 2 hours, and you can talk about a range of things. For example, we could talk about how it interacts with contemporary history and politics. It's technically very sophisticated. You can talk about that. And particularly interesting on a course about spy fiction, if we did put Mick Heron on, it would be the last, most recent one. So they would have done a whole semester, the history of it. We could talk about the way it plays with its own status as a spy novel, you know, from those jokes about James Bond to the sort of echoes of the Cold War and just the invention of Slough House I'm pretty sure that there could not be a Slough House. I'm sure that they would just pension off those people. And the Regent's Park is itself a kind of a bit of a conglomeration between MI5 and MI6, isn't it? But there's a lot to talk about.
Yeah, no, it's a wonderful series, and I've really enjoyed kind of diving deep with a number of different folks. And thank you so much for coming on and talking with me about it today.
It's been a real pleasure.
So if there's folks that want to keep up with what you're working on, is there a good way to do that? I know, you know, Edinburgh Spy Week is a little bit on a hiatus for the moment.
That's on hiatus for the moment because of the pandemic, and it will be for a while. I am on Twitter at Penn Fielding, and if you are so inclined, you can click on my university biography and find out other things that I've written, not all of which are about spying. but I'm on Twitter and Facebook.
Well, that's great. Thanks again for joining me, and we'll be watching that Twitter feed for your thoughts on the new TV show when it comes out, hopefully in the fall here. So for sure, we'll be checking that out.
Great.
Next episode is going to be a bit of a change of pace. I'll be hoping to do a little bit of a feedback show. So if you have any questions about Slough House or comments about the last book, what your thoughts are, is River going to make it? I'll be reading them out on the show, talking about your comments, and offer some other opinions and updates. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. So you can send those comments to me at barbicanstation@gmail.com, or feel free to message me on Twitter at barbicanstation. And I'll I'll also have an update about what's coming up next for the show, as we've now worked our way through the book series and with the most recent one. So I have some updates on what the plans are for that as well. If you are curious about more about the Slow Horses, I've written about them on my website, and I also have up-to-the-minute updates on the filming of the TV adaption and the first books. If you type slough.house in your web browser, it'll take you right there. That's slough.house. And you can follow the podcast, like I said, on Twitter at Barbican Station. If you want to find me specifically about all sorts of other stuff about spies, I'm at spywrite.com, and you can also find me on Twitter at spywrite. That's it for this episode. If you enjoyed it, please feel free to give us a rating on your preferred podcast app, drop me a comment telling me what you thought, and I'll be back soon. Until next time, thanks for listening.